Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Human Behavior Podcast. Today, we are talking about something that affects our perception and our cognitive performance even before we realize it's an issue. It's something we call OBE, which stands for Overcome by Emotion or Overwhelmed by Events. During the episode, we define in great detail what we mean by these terms and how they affect our ability to sense, make, and problem solve. But the reason we are talking about OBE is because it comes on much faster than we think and is often the biggest contributing factor to poor decision making. When we use the term overwhelmed, people often assume that we're talking about a situation or event that is highly chaotic or complex, but in reality, it can come on when we are running a few minutes late for an important event. During the episode, we give several examples of what we mean by OBE. We talk about the physiological and psychological processes that contribute to becoming overwhelmed by events or overcome by emotion. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode. If you want more, you can check out our Patreon channel, where we have a lot more content as well as subscriber-only episodes of the show. If you enjoy the podcast, kindly ask that you leave this review, and more importantly, please share it with a friend. Thank you for your time, and don't forget that training changes behavior. Good morning, Greg, and hello to all of our listeners. Recording this podcast kind of early in the morning, had an early start, had a long day, so wanted to get this in first before I become a victim of what we're going to be talking about today, actually. So today, we're talking about a term that we use called OBE, and, you know, there's sort of two sides to the coin of OBE. One being it means overwhelmed by events, and the other meaning it overcome by emotion. And so I want to talk about this as it relates to kind of human behavior, because, you know, it sounds like, okay, I'm overcome or overwhelmed. This is a chaotic situation. And oftentimes it's not. You're at that level before we realize it. And you know, this is another one of those sort of barriers to situational awareness, in a sense, kind of like we talked about last week, where we got into complacency in great detail. And we talked about how it's a barrier to having good sort of situational awareness or really, just sense making in general, I guess. Right. So this week, I want to discuss, you know, the OBE and, how it sort of clouds our judgment and our perception and causes poor decision making. And, you know, there's kind of a lot I want to get into about defining what those terms mean, how those situations occur. You know, we'll give some examples, and then what are some of the contributing factors, and there's obviously a lot that we're going to talk about with it. But, you know, I don't want people to hear the term overcome or overwhelmed by events or emotion and think it has to be something crazy and chaotic. It can be something quite simple. So I think maybe to start off, Greg, throw to you, and if you want to define those for us, and then we can kind of jump in from there.
Yeah. So if you understand the reason that there's two of them, then you'll be further ahead than most of the people that you're going to meet today. So the first one, the overwhelmed by events, that's a very simple one to understand. And we'll give a couple of extreme examples. Both Brian and I'll give you a personal example that you can hang on to. But I would tell you that, like last week, my flights were delayed. I took a 2.5-hour Uber drive. I had a 36-hour layover at an unfamiliar airport. All of those things contributed to me being a little bit overwhelmed by events. And when I say a little bit, that's my ego talking. I was completely overwhelmed, right? But it doesn't have to be that bad. It can be, hey, Dad, can you drive me to the library just before the kickoff, or they drop the puck on the Wings game? It can be having that flat tire and, you know, this was an important business meeting that we are going to, and gosh damn it, now I know I'm going to be late, and when I show up, my knee is going to be dirty and my hands are going to be filthy. So the overwhelmed by events is simply what happens is you have 100% of available attention, and anytime you start slipping outside of being able to attend to numerous things, you feel anxiety, which triggers emotions in the brain that say, danger, warning, Will Robinson, something's wrong. And once you get to that phase, which is much earlier than people think, then you're not functioning 100%. Your human performance drops. Now, if we look at the other side of the same coin, we see the overcome by emotions. Now, because Brian and I both have versions of PTS, Brian and I can be in a class talking about a topic and work each other into the level of being overcome by emotions. I remember having to stand up and talk at a funeral, and I had written a nice thing for my dear friend Bob Sunderland, and I had to pass it off to Nico. I couldn't get through the first sentence, but nothing would come out. So what you have to understand now with the emotions, and we'll dig deeper into this in a few minutes, it's physiological first, psychological second, and then when it's overwhelmed by events, it's psychological first and then physiological. And I know that sounds goofy, but let us kind of, you know, dive into the episode. I'd like to give you a personal example, Brian, of a big overwhelmed by events that happened to me back when we were building combat or ASAT for the Army, not Combat Hunter for the Marines, ASAT for the Army. So we were traveling around with General Robert Brown, three-star Army general, great guy, incredible leader. And Brown says, hey, take me to the range with these other 1 and 2 stars. I want to see your perspective. So we're walking around, marching around all day long on Lee Field, 1,000-meter range, big village, going in, meeting people, doing all that. And my phone is ringing off the hook, and it's our company back then. And it says, hey, you got to get to, the TBS, the leader school. They need a speaker to tell them what this program is. And that's a, 45-minute drive back to base, this, that, and the other. I go, yeah, I'm with General Brown. Yeah, I got it, but he's not paying the bills. Get your ass back. One of those things. So then on the way back, okay, there's one of those movements where they've got all the, they used to call them the trains, where all the vehicles are going by delivering stuff to a war zone. And so you've got the smaller trucks and the medium-sized trucks and the bigger trucks and security in front. And then there's these, orange-vested guys blocking the road. So I'm sure it's convoy ops training, right? Because it's not a Zompoc, but it's blocking me and the clock is going. And then I pull up in the parking lot. A guy meets me and he goes, hey, I just got hired by your company. I'm the new program manager. By the way, you didn't get a choice. It's me. This is how things are going to be. Brian, I could not think of what to say when I walked into that room that was ready for me going, hey, you're a little bit late. First slide came up and I had to sit down. I didn't know what to do. And what had happened is I had exceeded all of those file folders that I had ready, all the preparation that I had done, all the anticipation for the event had just been retarded by these external forces. And now I couldn't hit. It was like a rotor that was going by and it was wet. So it wasn't hitting the spark just right and nothing was there. And I must have looked and seemed like an idiot. Because then I walked out and the program manager go, hey, what's the deal? And I go, hey, I think I need to go to the emergency room because I'm not sure. I've never had this feeling before. It's so debilitating, right, Brian, that it scared me. You see what I mean? Now, that's an extreme example. And I didn't add all the minutia of being dehydrated, having smoked 8 packs of menthols, in the rental car on the way there, stuff that I did, 15 years ago, 12 years ago. But listen to me. I felt it physically, physiologically and psychologically, and I could not finish. And it's the first time ever in my career that I couldn't just get up in front of a group of people and start talking.
No, and that's an awesome example of exactly what we're talking about. Whereas one, it's something that you do all the time, public speaking. Two, a program that you wrote, yep. And we're doing you're 100% completely in your comfort zone with everything of where. I mean, this is not even. You're not in some outside element. You're not forward deployed or something, you're back in the US
under fire, right?
No. And that's definitely why I wanted to hit that up right at the beginning. And I do want you though, we can go ahead and jump into it, cause I'll share some other stories as well. But you talked about physiological first, psychological second, psychological first, physiological first. What do you mean by that? And kind of, explain what you mean by that, because I think that's a powerful way to look at it, to understand the different mechanisms that come into play and how it affects you in those moments, and why we kind of, it's actually a great reason why we call it overwhelmed by events or overcome by emotion, right? Yep. That's why the two sides are there. So please explain that.
And listen, for purists that are out there, you can use just one. because OBE itself will cover both sides of the same coin.
Yeah,
but we create the differentiation because when you're functioning at a high level, you have to understand the brain and how it works in human performance. So anytime you have more than one task, we call it multitasking. And anytime you multitask, you go from the 100% level down, and you only have 100%, so you can never exceed that. Even with training, you can manage it better, but you can never exceed it completely. And so what happens is your brain's has glucose, and glucose is the metabolic essential fuel for the brain. And what happens is each time that you're processing information, you get a reduction of brain glucose. But what happens with multitasking is now you're pulling on those reserves from different angles, from different levels at different speeds, and you get to the point where the glucose impairment now starts impairing other physiological function, cognitive functions, reflexes, autonomic abilities start to fail. And then if it's not rapidly corrected, and I don't mean just having a Powerade, I mean, you have to sit down, separate yourself, you know, do some breathing exercises, focus back to where you were, it can lead to brain damage or death. And I'll give everybody an example that if they've had any service member ever in their family, when you're deployed, the first thing you're taught if you're in a leadership position is to stay up longer than everybody else. There's no scientific reason that you got to do that, because if you're a leader and you've got a team.
You're certainly not taught that.
You're taught that by your mentors. You're taught that by other people that you see, whether it's formal or not. You think that you have to stay up longer. And what happens is that's a huge depletion of your brain's glucose supply. And multitasking depletes it even faster. And now you're in stupid. And I made up that word just for the reason, you know. Exactly. Stupid. You're surrounded by this fog of stupidity, and it's hard to get out. And Brian, sometimes it becomes so overwhelming that it leads to physiological death, or it is a downward spiral, Trent Reznor, to a death-like feeling, and then you can't help yourself, and you could die. So. The ultimate end of it is that your emotional toll and the events that are around you can lead to a debilitating low of essential metabolic fuel. And it hits the brain first, and then it goes to the extremities. And the further the extremities are, guess what? You know, you get none. So now you're clod hopping around feeling like a dinosaur, like a T-Rex.
And that's a good way to look at it. And you said it right off the bat, OBE is the same thing, and I look at it as just from different sort of mechanisms at play. So I can have all of a sudden something chaotic happens in front of me, and there's all this going on, and I gotta rush to the scene or whatever. I'm already overwhelmed by the events, but you know, before I get there, maybe I got a lot going on in my life and I'm tired and I haven't slept well, like you talked about. Then I've got all this other stress, and then I've got money issues, and I've got this. You start to become, you get that anxiety building. You can become overcome by emotion before you even get in. And so that's kind of what happened to me in a time when I was, it was kind of in the early days when we were still starting Arcadia, and I was still working down, you know, doing some of the tactical training stuff I was doing. I'd fly up, and, you know, I was going to meet, they were long, you know, it was, you know, working basically every day for like 5 straight weeks, and then a couple of weeks off, and then same thing, kind of going back and forth. And I was away from home, and I was still engaged to my now wife at the time, but I was taking a break, and I'm going to go up to Michigan to one of my best friends. I mean, one of my buddies from the Marine Corps, I went through sniper school with, he was getting married, and, you know, we were going to go up there and meet. I was going to meet my wife there when we got landed and go there. And, you know, and I'm stressed already. We're doing stuff in the background, trying to get Arcadia going. I've got, you know, I was still like finishing up grad school, working full time and long ass hours in the Georgia heat. So it was like, it was tough, man. I was in it. And, you know, I remember I was flying up to Chicago. We were linking up there, and then we're going to drive from there to Michigan, to my buddy's place, like in 2 hours from where we were meeting up at. And, you know, things are looking good. You know, I was a little rushed to the airport, but got there, realized I got a free upgrade to first class because I was flying Delta all the time. So I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm going to chill. I'm going to have a beer. And then what had just come out on Delta too, was the, there was a documentary on the 85 Chicago Bears, which is the 86 Super Bowl, but 85 season. And it was like, oh, cool. Like, this is awesome. I'm going to sit here for 2 hours and nostalgia about the Bears and have a beer, and it's going to be great. Well, you know, and, you know, so I don't even have anyone sitting next to me. It's like the plane's loading. Then it's like kind of getting a little bit late. And then all of a sudden this woman comes on, and based on her behavior and things I've seen before, she looked like she was intoxicated in some type, whether that was alcohol, drugs, a combination of both. There was a little something going on. And then sure enough, she sits right next to me, and I'm like, okay. And she's doing the awkward, like saying hi to everyone, you know, trying to kind of like co-opt people as she goes, like telling the flight attendant, like, oh, I really love those earrings. And like, oh,
that's not
this.
That bad. I'm like, I'm really not an animal. Right.
Yes, I know what this behavior is. Like, I've seen this before. And so she sits down and she starts to try to talk to me. And I'm kind of trying to be polite because I don't feel like talking to her. And, you know, I'm just watching this thing. And then she gets like a glass of champagne and she's still talking to me, spills the entire glass on me, like knocks it off the little armrest thing. And just like the whole entire thing went into my lap. So I'm like, okay. Like, just, I'm starting to get a little heated, right? She doesn't shut up. I'm sitting down. So now I've got the headphones in, staring at the little screen in front of me, like just trying to get into this show. And she keeps talking to me and like touching me and be like, hey, like interrupting the show. And I'm like, hey, I'm sorry. Like, I don't mean to be rude. I just really kind of want to watch this. Actually, it came out a while ago and I didn't get a chance to see it. So I'm just kind of, you know, got a lot going on. I really just want to chill here and watch this. And then she kept talking and kept interrupting, kept going on, and then started arguing with me. And I was so, because remember, add the anxiety of you're in a plane. I cannot go anywhere.
Just get up and walk away.
There's no exit strategy here. And like, it just, I could feel it building. And like, I'm looking at her just wanting to grab her head and like jam it through the airplane window and out and like let her get sucked out. Like, that was what was going on in my head. And I could not stand it. I literally had to stand up and I walked up to the flight attendant. I said, is there anywhere else on this plane that you can put me and I can go sit down? I don't care if I'm sitting in the shitter the whole flight. I don't care if it's in 47F with, you know, someone in my, like, I got to hold someone's kid in my lap. I don't care. Just put me anywhere. And she was like, oh my God. And so thankfully there was a guy across the aisle who saw everything happen. And he was a little bit older and he was just chilling there like with his scotch and he was laughing and he walked right up. He goes, hey man, why don't you take my seat? I'll sit there. And I was like, thank you, sir, so much. I appreciate it. And I sat down. But like in the point was, in that moment, I was because of all of those factors. Look, man, just trying to get, I want to get to my buddy's wedding. I haven't seen my wife, then fiance for a few weeks. Like, I'm stressed out. Like, I'm just trying, I just want to go let loose with the boys who I haven't seen in years. Like, you know, all this went into this. I had to take special days off from there. I had to get it all approved. Like, all this stuff is going on in my head. And I was OBE, man. I was completely overwhelmed. I was overcome by emotion in that moment. I had to like take, thankfully, like stand up, walk away, take a breath, and someone intervened sort of on my behalf, thankfully, which was hilarious because then he talked to her the whole flight. We got off and I was getting off and then he grabbed me in the terminal. He's like, hey, man, you owe me like a really nice bottle of scotch. I go, I owe you like a so case true. Of scotch. He goes, that woman was batshit crazy. I go, I know. And it was really bothering me. I like hugged the guy. I was like, thank you so much. I don't know what I was going to do. He's like, you're all good. I saw it happen. But the thing was, it wasn't any one of those individual factors, right? Like we said, it starts to add up. Because when she was first bothering me, I'm sitting there going like, fucking, like, I'm already pissed when, because I was coming in at this level way up here and I had all this going on without the recognition of that happening. And so it automatically took me to that place where I'm just like, I am going to kill someone on an airplane. Like, this is going to happen. So
when we talk, you and I talk a lot to other people and on podcasts and in webinars and everything. And we always make the distinction of normalcy and we say clinically normal. And some people know what that
typical means
and some people don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So first part of unpacking Brian's story. Humans are social beings. They need to belong to a group. It's not a desire to belong to a group. It's a need. You have to fill the need. So that's why she was walking around playing her game, because she knows she's an outlier, and she knew that she had to get into the good graces of the group of people to be belonged, even for that short flight. But emotions are a distant early warning system, and they're hardwired into your brain. So you got the danger warning, Will Robinson, when she was coming through the threshold onto the fuselage of the plane. You smelled, saw, felt something about her that was different from the baseline that you anticipated to have in first class on Delta, because you had done thousands of flights at that time. So now, if you have those two things alone, you have turbidity, you have turmoil. Now, we understand that fear can trigger this fight or flight response, right? And now you've got the binary, stay and face the danger or flee to safety. But you're in a situation that you can't flee. You cannot leave that physical structure. So now the cost-benefit analysis starts tipping towards her. Okay, now add to that that your emotions are preparing your body for action. The amygdala is specifically triggering emotional responses to prepare you, because it senses something different. Now, it doesn't know whether it's fear or anger, and it doesn't care. It knows that what it needs to do is motivate you to do something in this moment, and that motivation can be negative or positive. What do I mean negative? You biting her head off, you choking her to death, you punching her, throwing her out. Or positive, you going, ma'am, I apologize, I have to move seats, I got to do something, because this just isn't cutting it. So what you have, again, look, if you're a copper, or if you're HR, or if you're a jailer, what you have to understand is these things are always in play. And the brain senses the change first, so it starts building up the chemical interactions for the fear or the anger. And that starts taking those choices out of your physical, corporeal control. What does that mean? That means that the program is running without you. And all of a sudden, you find out that you're swept up in the program, and that's OBE. So the moment that you realize OBE, OBE has already been running for some time. Now that could be nanoseconds, Brian, but it doesn't matter, because that makes it feel out of your control. I want everybody to envision being a trapeze artist, and you're going off and you're swinging, right? And you're now going to let go, and the other person's going to catch you, and you look while you're in midair, and there's no motherfucker on that other bar. Okay, that's what you feel like. You feel like sailing through the air with no safety net, right? You're a Walenda, and all of these effects are happening to you. And that has a psychological toll as well as a physiological toll. You feel it inside, and it manifests as an emotion. So these things, look, you know why we had to name them? Because nobody else had. And everybody had a description of them, the doctors and the scientists and everything else. So the OBE just sounded right. It just felt right. And then somebody says, yeah, well, is there a difference between emotions and events? And it's, yeah, clearly there are. So we can make those two distinctions. But you don't need to. You see what I mean?
You're a scientist. We explained this in a couple different ways, right? Like you said, you know, sometimes psychological leads to physiological, sometimes physiological leads to psychological, but either way, and that's why we break down is sometimes it's the events, the environment, sometimes it's your emotions. And then when those two things combine, like in my situation on the plane, I had all that. And I like the way you said it. You said it's like a program that's running without you. So that's on. And then there's a hopefully there's a recognition. Like in my part, I was like, okay, I need to change the situation. And some people don't have the skills to do that. You know, this is why you see people freak out over little things. It's never really about that little thing, right? There's always something else going on. It's even with the kids, even with the insurgent, she gets pissed because I was like, well, you got to get up, you got to get that done now. And she just all of a sudden freaks out of nowhere. And that's when me and my wife look at each other and like, okay, why don't you go take a breath? And I'm like, this react, because it's great in kids too, because it's so obvious where you have this wild overreaction to something and you're like, that doesn't fit. So clearly there's something else that she was thinking about and going on in her world that we had no idea that she was thinking, because we're like, why are you acting this way?
My mom, my old school mom, and I mean old school, old country mom, would always say, you know, kids and crazy people always tell the truth. And I would have to pick at that to see what she was talking about. But she meant they had the most pure form of emotions. They didn't filter the emotions for us. And Brian, your brain is set up, and we know this, but I'm talking to the crowd and the audience that we hopefully have those three people sitting up this morning. The idea is that your brain gives you a series of chances, and it reintroduces file folders to get you to catch on. Now, it will do the survival mechanism without you if it has to, but it would love to go along with you. So I'll give you an example of that. Animals growling or animals showing their teeth, snake rattling. Okay. The animal's emotions are giving us that final warning before they strike. Now, there were other things that we should have noticed before that in the environment, but we missed them. So humans do the same thing. Humans engage in nonverbals. And I'm so sick and tired of reading these gosh damn people come back and forth with all the neural this and that and everything else. Look, the facial expressions were set up to display your personal emotion at that moment in time. And whether you're lying, a fake smile, the giggle, all that other stuff, they indicate intent in a social situation. Your intent is to comply. Your intent is that I'm getting angry and I'm not going to comply. Facial expressions are so important in every social interaction. And then what did we try to turn that into? Kinesics. This means this. No, what you do is you watch for the confluence of all of them. And whether you're on a traffic stop or whether you're talking to a kid in school or whether you're about to let somebody go, the face determines the likelihood of the action via emotion. Okay, I'm looking around. I'm not making eye contact. I'm scratching my face. Hey, I'm thinking of not being here. Okay, those type of reactions, right? I'm, you know, baring my teeth. I'm leaning forward to you and I'm pointing and indicating you. That's indicating that I'm at a threshold and I may lash out. So we have all of these nonverbals on board to help lubricate social interactions that are uncomfortable.
And no, and I really liked how you brought it up right there is those sort of early, well, those are the last warning signals, right? That's yeah. The shoulders coming up, the balling of the fist, the bulging absolutely. Neck vein. And the thing is, you brought up where everyone goes, see, these are, you know, the indicators, the pre-attack indicators. It's like, okay, I get that, but there's this entire world beforehand, and that's why we use that term OBE, because that's the time and distance part. So the reason and why we're talking about OBE when it comes to human behavior, it's the recognition of it is am I OBE and adding the situation, is this person OBE? Because if I can identify that sooner, I don't have to wait until they take a step back on that foot and bring their shoulders up, because that's when the now punch is coming. It's too exactly. late at that point. Exactly. And those are so obvious. So these are the less obvious things when you're out running your headlights, when you're driving too fast in the rain, when it's the snow blindness, right? When the yep. snow is coming down hard where you're at and it's storming real bad, like you cannot process that much information. It's too much. You have to physically slow down. So if I think about it in the vehicle,
exactly.
especially if I don't have the right type of tires and I don't have good driver training or whatever, and I'm driving in the rain, like you are outrunning your headlights traveling that quickly. And so you have to slow time down. So yeah. it's taking your foot off that gas pedal. And so that yes. those events in the environment combined with the different emotional state is that's the powder keg, and the you can recognize all of those elements laying out there on the ground before someone walks up with a lit match and you're going, oh, I see what it is. You know what
exactly.
I'm saying?
Exactly.
With a little thumbs up just popped up. I don't know. There's little emoji things on here when you do hand and arm signals.
Oh, really? So, yay.
Just look at thumbs up. Oh, I got one.
It did come up. It did come up. So listen, let's change lenses, but stay focused. So pareidolia. Now, we've talked about that in other episodes very briefly, but you know, it's what causes people to see faces in inanimate objects. So if somebody asks me, well, you talk about cognitively close enough. Yeah, pareidolia is cognitively close enough. What does it mean? It means you're going through an environment and all of a sudden a cauliflower hits your periph because some waiter's walking by with it, and you look at it and you see the baby Jesus in the cauliflower. What it is your file folders are constantly moving, trying to anticipate the situation you're about to get into. Now, while most of that is sedentary, we eat and sleep a lot more than we think, right? What happens is when I see a trigger in my environment, that trigger sends a message to my brain and going, hey, be aware, that might be your neighbor from across the street. And because we need to be part of this social fabric, I have to grin and go, hi, Jim. Hi, Mary. Okay. So pareidolia is a defense mechanism, like the rattle on a snake is a defense mechanism, not saying, hey, I'm going to attack you for no reason. It's saying, hey, you're in my AO, stay outside. So pareidolia becomes that emotional distant early warning system to make sure that you don't miss those connections that are essential in your world. Now, because the female that came on the plane wasn't essential to your world, You weren't planning on breeding with her. You weren't planning on killing her and eating her. You didn't need somebody to fill in that long flight with conversation. What happened is you socially excluded her. I guarantee that you gave a facial expression. I guarantee that numerous times you verbalized those nonverbals and said, no, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah. Right.
But she wasn't catching on. So now this social contract that was inevitable, that you were forced into, that wasn't your own. Okay. Now you have to act it out. It's you're on the fucking train and you can decide to stop at the next station, or you can pull that thing that stops the train and everybody rolls forward, you know, in the old movies. Okay. But your brain never wants to pull that thing because it says right on the box for emergency only. So there's always a dance. Your emotional processing network, your amygdala, hippocampus, prefrontal cortex, cingulates are constantly functioning to make sense of your environment. And emotions are how you do that. Emotions are so essential to fulfilling that social contract. Look, what do we warn people about? If you're writing a manifesto, Houston, we may have a problem. Why? Because those people have a broken social contract, right?
Yeah.
They don't have the necessary human performance to be in the tribe anymore. And look, I want you to look at all of the stories that were written about city mouse and country mouse, and written about the grasshopper that didn't take time to fill up the food store and the ants did. You know that ancient ships, Brian, and I mean ancient from a long time ago, I mean like from the 1400s, these big masted ships that we saw recreated off the coast of San Diego. They carried supplies for 2 or 3 years. Why? Because their social contracts were longer. They were going to be on that ship for a good long time. So you have to create these relationships through these emotions and events. And guess what? If we get overwhelmed by them, we're not functioning at 100%.
No, and we get overwhelmed, and that's why I brought it back to getting overwhelmed. It's not the best way because of what people picture when they say overwhelmed, and that can happen so quickly. And
exactly.
You brought up a number of different things you were talking about, especially with this expectation of how things are supposed to go. And then you talk about pareidolia, about, you know, I have to find meaning in everything that's happening.
Yes.
So my brain can make sense of it. You know, that's the, I see the face in the clouds, or the Jesus on the piece of toast was one of my favorites.
Yep.
You know, I will attribute meaning to these different objects or symbols or something that I see, because that's just my brain making order out of chaos. And,
exactly.
it sort of has to do that, like you said, as a defense mechanism. So I'm not surprised by anything. But the OBE comes in, can happen rapidly. I mean, and your level of cognitive acumen and training and life experience and emotional maturity and all these things you want to call it is going to dictate how well you respond to it. But eventually everyone has a point, no matter who you are, no matter you're the Dalai Lama himself. Remember the Pope took a swing at someone when they
slapped that one
water.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah, he slapped her, or she was grabbing him, wouldn't let go, or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Like, he was pulling him with the handshake, right.
And I was mixing up the Tom Cruise one where he got sprayed with water in the movie, but
couldn't find the right emotion.
He didn't know what to do because he didn't expect it, and he's supposed to be there and act a certain way at the movie theater or at the movie premiere and be professional and promote it and be happy and be approachable because he's a star. And same thing with the Pope, like he's supposed to do all this stuff and these are the people. And then, you know, the woman was hanging on too long and it got him, and he became OBE and he slapped her. And so it's like if the Pope can do it, what chance do I have of not becoming, you know, OBE? And that's, you know, our and this is our approach to everything in a sense with HBPRNA and how we approach situations and sense making and decision making. But the idea is I don't want to get to that level because it's going to have an amygdalic response that cares about my survival. So it pushes everything into, just like me on the plane. Hey man, this is rough. This is not good. We can't get out of here. I don't like this. And it raises the anxiety level. And then that can manifest itself in certain ways. But no matter how well you trained you are, no matter how, you know, emotionally mature, and no matter how long, Greg, you've been reading your stoicism books that you love reading, like it doesn't matter, because you're still going to get that physiological and psychological reaction to that situation, which limits your cognitive performance. It limits your ability to make better decisions. It limits your ability to sense, make, and problem solve. And so what everyone wants is the, okay, well, what do I do? Okay. And that's great. Like, you can do the breathing and focusing, but like, you know, my big thing is, you know, it's one thing at a time. It's yes. One step at a time. When I get to that level, I have to stop and say, hold on here, and go to use the Brian Willis term. What's important now?
Right.
What can I look at or affect change in right now? And the great one is you can always start with yourself in a sense, right?
Course.
You can always go, maybe I can't de-escalate you, Greg Williams, but I can de-escalate Brian, you know, and that alone is a way to sort of regain control. And when you have a little bit more of a control, because that was back to me on the plane, like I'm completely out. I have no control of the situation. Literally, yes. I cannot change
where we're
headed. I'm in this aluminum tube of emotion, you know what I mean? Like hurtling through the air at 600 miles an hour.
Okay.
And it's just building and building and building. Yeah. So you get what I'm saying?
So I would say this though. I would say that use the gift of time and distance the way it was designed. Say to yourself, I anticipate that this situation that I'm going to do in 45 minutes has all the earmarks of being an OBE situation. Therefore, I'm going to conduct predictive analysis, and know going in what those triggers might be. Now, what you've done is you've changed to being in stride, where it's occurring as you're walking down the street or riding a bike or, you know, knock on the door. Now, what you're saying is, if the knock on the door comes, I'm ready for it. And I want you to see yourself first naked. And I know how hard that is for some people, but envision me naked if that hurts. And what happens is your naked self is your
terrifying
brain. And then the emotions are the clothes that you wear all during the day. And those emotions are playing a vital role in creating connections and building attachments. So that's why you go along to get along. You've heard that term before. And they motivate us to act in certain instances. And what I mean by that is your emotions are helping coordinating your interpersonal relationships as a guide, because what they're doing is they're measuring our expected level of safety in a certain situation. How will I get out of this? How will I be treated? Will the food be good? Am I going to like this vacation? Those things are happening to the left of bang. So why the fuck wouldn't you want to use the gift of time and distance and plan there? You have to be in the moment to measure what those emotions will be like. And I'll give you one that we haven't covered yet, grief. So grief is essential. It's hardwired. So go back to naked Remo, okay? You haven't put the clothes on yet to go to the funeral. Why are funerals important to humans? Because the grieving process shows that other people care about me, that just because my primary caregiver or my dear friend has died, I still have a support system. That's essential to community building, Brian. So the sociological implications of grief are such that you're hardwired to accept that it's going to be sad for a while, and then it's going to get better. And look who's around me. These are the folks that are going to help me get there. If not, then everything would be the, it'll never work. We're all going to die. You see what I'm trying to say? And we'd never come out of the cave. Plato would be pushed to the side, and the fire would run out because we'd run out of fuel. We can't do that. So the vital role in those connections is so essential, and the motivation to act is going to be there. So you might as well get left of it as far as you can and anticipate. So what type of situations would there be? A busy parking lot. Okay. Anticipation. Hey, anxiety is going to be high. I know that I might get OBE, so let's calm down. Road rage. I'm on a busy road. People, you know, there's a construction site. People are cutting in without turning. So if you can learn to anticipate those and predict that they're the situations that are going to be the most turbidity or turmoil, then you can ease your way through those situations with training and with repetition and with rehearsal. But the people don't do that, do they? People are like, oh, here comes the, you know, we're going to have the donkey for the gosh damn birthday party, and we're going to have the pinata and all this other shit. And then it rains and their whole life is on edge from that moment forward. Right. You got to have plans. You have to plan ahead to allow your emotions to rule those things that they do, and you rule the things that you do.
And the anticipation part is huge. We'll do that for simple things sometimes. It's like, okay, it's raining today. Mm-hmm. Crap, I got to leave 10 minutes early because I know traffic is going to be bad. Okay, that seems simple, and we've done that before. Or, hey, it might rain today. I better bring an umbrella or bring a jacket. Yep. I mean, those are basic level things that we don't often apply to situations where we should, and we don't often think about how it's going to affect us. And it just reminded me of one actually when I was in the Marine Corps, and when one of the deployments I did is a MEU, and you're on ship, and you go around stop at different places to do training stuff. But you know, we were going to go into the Philippines, and this village just had this huge mudslide, killed a ton of people, and you know, it was just, you know, it was a national disaster basically. And we were going to go send us in to help out and clean up and bring in supplies and water and food and all this stuff, right? And you know, so there's sort of protocols and procedures for that stuff when you're on that type of deployment. People are packing, getting their stuff ready, and who's going, who's not. Like, I didn't actually end up getting to go onto that one. It was just they only use so many people. But the idea was, you know, everyone's going through their normal procedural planning stuff, and then thankfully one of the leadership pulled everyone in and is like, hey, I just want to frame this for everyone, and I want you to think about what we're going to do. These people just lost members of their family. This is a national thing, like, you know, and this is a poor area, so it's not what anyone even in the U.S. is used to seeing. Is like, okay, these like mud hut villages basically with like, you know, straw huts, and you know, you're going in here, here's what just happened. I mean, everyone knew that, and everyone had seen stuff like that before. Like, everyone was already combat vets and everything for the most part, but it took everyone to go, took one person to say, stop, let's think about what we're doing. Yep. These people have suffered a terrible loss. They're going to be happy that you're there helping, but don't forget that this is what's going on. And you think about it like, well, that's implicit. You guys knew that. It's like, no, we didn't. We were young, and we were thinking about what our mission and what we had to do. So how would our approach have been maybe if we went into that situation without being cognizant of that? And you know, again, it sounds so, you know, basic or simple, but it really isn't, because that's anticipation that allows me to say, oh, okay, I can see this from a distance. I'm going to be dealing with grieving people. How do we best approach that and not just be so laser focused on our mission that we piss a bunch of people off or something? And it was because it was outside the role of what, you know, Marines typically train for, yep, right? It's not their fighting force, not a you know, FEMA national disaster response force.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was outside of the purview of what you're typically used to seeing. So it took someone to go, and then everyone kind of went, oh yeah, crap. Like, we, you know, it's not that we weren't taking it seriously or something, but the emotional, you know, recognition wasn't there beforehand because we're not used to that stuff. And so that 5 minutes or 3 minutes that he took to tell everyone, yep, that was probably one of the best things they could have done to impact the effectiveness of that mission and how people acted and how they treated everyone. And so when it comes down to, you know, what you brought up with anticipation, that helps with time and distance. And we always, yep, hit time and distance. Well, this is another thing of not allowing yourself to become OBE and the recognition. You actually gave the story, I think last week, of the one of when we were in St. Louis, even just recording a podcast, and you had hit that point because you were tired, and we had a long week, and you were sick like physically sick.
Yeah, right.
Now we're having an hour and a half long conversation with two great professionals.
Geniuses.
And
exactly.
You're trying to, you know, perform in a sense in this really tough situation, even though there's other people, and you become overwhelmed and you say things you don't always mean, or you say things and they come across wrong, and people take it the wrong way, or whatever can happen. But it's those little things are how the situation can spiral out of control. So it's, yep, all of those elements are laying out on the ground. So if I have that recognition of what those elements are, I don't need to see the bomb put together. I can see enough pieces and go, precisely, hey, I think we're in a bomb maker's house, right? And that's what you're talking about with sort of this overcome by events and overcome by emotion, is it the recognition of it, the anticipation of going into a situation and just having those mental models to draw from is to go, it's enough to not allow the situation to get out of hand. Does that kind of make sense?
No, it's exactly it. And you're spot on. And this goes back to the allegory of the mirror. So we've created that in all old houses. Just before you go outside, there's a mirror because they had to make sure that your hat was right, your ascot was perfect, you know, all your buttons were buttons and everything else. And now people really don't care much about that. But there's a mirror in your car. There's a mirror, hopefully at your office, your desk. And I always carry a mirror around with us when we travel. A very small travel mirror, signal mirror, actually, with the hole in it so I can look up at the plane, a survival tool. But the idea is I glance at it just before I get out of that hotel room, just before I get onto the elevator, just before I get out of the car. Look, things are about to happen. Am I prepared for this? Now, I don't give a shit if it's going in and getting a burger and an order of fries. Am I ready for the fast food experience that I'm about to engage? Hey, I've got the dog on a leash in one hand. I've got the keys to the house. And I've got all these other things going. Am I ready to walk out this door right now? Because there's a little bit of snow on the ground. What are the likely effects that I'll be facing? If I get used to doing that, then it becomes a habit. And a habit is a hard thing to break. And what I've done is I've named and given a physical form to anticipation. And those anticipations mean that I'm not going to get surprised. Look, I put on the red and blues. I pick the spot. I ask the person over the loudspeaker, go a little bit further off the road, you know, because I don't want to get squashed. Those considerations are easy to make. But just before I leave the car, why don't I adjust my own mirror and take a look at myself and say, hey, I don't want this to be my homicide scene. And I don't want, the Axon body cam to not use the officer-involved shooting, but to watch the suspect kill me. If you do that, Brian, that spinal tuning, that adjustment of your critical thinking is essential.
No, and I that's the same thing sort of I do, and I like how you pose it as a question, almost as a challenge to yourself, because everyone has different ways to, you know, I see different types of advice out there. Well, I know how I am and what works for me, and I kind of know a little bit about what works for all humans, and that's the perfect example. So before, let's say, you know, if we're going, we're traveling, we're going, you know, do a training course, whatever, going in for the day, I do the same thing because, you know, every hotel has that mirror somewhere, like right by the door, usually, of it's almost like a full size wall size mirror. And I always stop, take a look at myself, and it's not, hey, you got this. I'm not doing the Stuart Smalley, you know, you're good enough, you're smart enough, doggone it, people like you. No, it's not that. It's not the talk yourself up confidence. It's the, are you prepared for this? Are you ready to give 100%? Yeah. So literally, am I squared away, right? Do I look professional? But it's that looking yourself in the mirror, and you even just brought into the car, like looking at yourself in that rear view mirror, like, okay, are you prepared to handle this? And because one, your brain loves challenges. And two, it's forcing you cognitively to step up your game without having to have a checklist of the things you need to do or where to look or what you're carrying or where your gun or knife or whatever weapon is. It's are you prepared? And those little examples of psychological priming is kind of what you're doing, because you likely know what you need to do. You likely have the ability to handle that. So it's just, are you prepared? And those small deliberate steps are how I prevent myself becoming, you know, OBE, because there's times in the morning where, you know, we got in late, didn't sleep well. Yep. We made some last minute changes, and I was going through it in the morning to make sure. And it's like, that's when I have to stop. And I'm like, okay, I'm in the safety of the hotel room. We've got plenty of time. You know, Greg's already down there by the car. I said, we're going to leave.
Sitting holding my bag.
It's only 6:45 and I'm already walking down to the car. Right. So it's like, take that breath and stop and go, okay, let's not focus on any of that stuff that happened yesterday. It's what can I do to kind of give my best, you know, today for those folks that are going to be in class.
Yeah.
And I, that time and time again, I put it back on me. Not, are you prepared to handle this chaotic situation or this, that, or the other thing? It's like, no, are you at your best? Are you operating at your best right now? And that's when sometimes you come in and we, you know, I'm like, Greg, like I slept like shit last night. Like I was up, I was this, or I was sick. And then you'll be like, oh, all right, cool, man. I got it. Don't worry. Like, you know, I got it this morning. Now, it didn't change our roles or how much work we were doing or whatever, but I know that you're like, oh, I'm good, man. I'm ready to get this. So I cognitively, what does that do? That prevents me from going, oh, man, I'm going to screw up today, or that anxiety is not going to creep in. And we do the same thing where I'm like, you're calling sick. And I'm like, hey, we got to stop at Walmart to get this medication. I might have to go here. I'm like, cool, I got it. Don't worry. I'll take this stuff. And you're like, you're still going to go put out.
Wonderful for me. Yep.
But it takes away some of that turbidity, right? It makes it a little bit clearer.
Yeah. And what you're talking about, what Brian's talking about, folks, is reducing cognitive load. So everybody's got a cognitive load, and everybody's used to functioning at that load. And the more load that we put on the truck, the suspension is going to interact with fuel, the mileage, everything changes. We're wearing out the tires sooner. So what you like to operate it is less cognitive load. So I'll give you an example of that. Every single time Brian and I go into a venue, we set up the room and we move things around. And what we're trying to do is reduce cognitive load. Don't worry, folks. You sit here and you sit there. By making those choices for folks, you're telling them, welcome. This is cool. It's a safe, happy environment. And that reduces anxiety. That reduces turbidity and turmoil. So if we do that in our normal life, like what about Bob? You remember the movie, Baby Steps.
Oh, yeah.
Baby Bill Steps Murray. To the elevator. Yeah. Well, I take a photo, and you know this because sometimes when we share photos, I'm sure I share ones that you don't want to see. But I take a photo in the mirror of the hotel that morning before every class, me standing there, and you've probably seen hundreds of those of me. And the idea is, Greg, are you ready?
Yeah, just can you start sending I just asked if you could send them to me after you put clothes on, though.
Yeah. Listen, I'm like the doll that you dress in different. I give you options, Brian. Does Greg wear the skirt today, or is he going to wear the slacks? But the idea is that by looking at that photo is for me. That tattoo is for me, right? That icon is for me. And what it does is it gets me out that door in the morning. Am I prepared for the challenge on the other side of the door? Now I'm in the hallway. What should I see? What am I seeing? What are the smells and feels and tastes from here to the elevator? When the elevator door opens, you know me, man, I'm looking. And when we're on there and when the rental car, I can tell if you're on the phone making the Starbucks order or if you're on the phone looking at the map because there's been a change in direction or distance. And those things fill my cognitive load at the exact right level. And that makes me feel good. But if some of those things are lacking or there's too much, we're right back to the baseline plus anomaly, right? Then I know that there's going to be changes. Now, look, God, Buddha, Vishnu, Allah has given us shock absorbers to take up some of that. And there's stress relievers like laughter, for example, is a perfect stress reliever. And it can be spontaneous laughter, right?
Alcohol.
Alcohol, yeah, it was in Brian's life. But the idea is that if we don't engage in those cognition management tools, then we're going to be playing pinball all day long, and we're going to take all the damage, hail damage to a car. We're going to be out in the hail all day long, weathering the storm. And then by the time we get back to the room or to have dinner or to work out, we're going to be toast. And you can't operate at that for a long time because it will make you overwhelmed. And once you become overwhelmed, you're not at peak performance. So here we are back to that human performance, right? So everything, look, I'd love to say, we only teach a skill that's useful in combat, but it's not. It's the same skill that I would use the first time I met somebody or talking to a neighbor's kid that just busted a window, accidentally playing football or baseball or something, right? These are life skills. And the life cycle is such that because we understand the emotional register and we understand the weight of upcoming events, we can manage them. People that manage things. Have you ever seen a person that was traveling alone completely asleep at an airport? What happened there? Okay. How could you do that? That's like even sleeping on a plane. I don't know these folks. Unless I'm with somebody that's being my guardian angel, I can't do that. And that worries me about society because when I see those things, that's like the article I just sent you about the 26-year-old kid that said he'd been homeless on the streets for 9 years. Brian, we're broken if that's a true story. You see what I'm trying to say? We as society are broken because OBE is a warning. And if we understand that warning now, we can do steps to mitigate it before the next OBE. And just the knowledge, I think just the knowledge that there is such a thing as OBE, both sides of the same coin, should make you smarter or should make you more cautious.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, is it's sort of that the more, if I have words to put to something,
yep.
I can get better at the recognition of it. Right. I mean, that's even just in my day-to-day stuff. If I've got, back to back calls and I'm stressed and something happened and this is that, like when I go back into the house from my little office here, like it's, that doesn't come in with me. I have to go, all right, now I got to be dad. So it's that taking that breath and not bringing that in and going, okay, well that's work. Now I have the kids and the baby and my wife, yep. Like, so why bring that in there? Everyone, people will say, well, that's still on your mind. This is like, yeah, it is, but it's not right now. Right now I'm being deliberate on this. And yep. That allows me to not become overwhelmed when, the insurgent is, stressed about whatever and, talking back to her mom or something like that, yep. And so I'm not going to come off, I'm less likely to come off the top rope. And that was a big one for me too. I've told this story on here before, but I remember back in the day, we were working with the infantry immersive trainers, behavioral scientists, cognitive scientists. And we're talking about, what was people call stress inoculation and, yep. And, making these type of scenarios and how to cognitively get people involved and the emotional regulation and this. And so they would have these sidebar conversations and ask me about different experiences or how I handle things or how this works. And then, I was like, I'm pretty good at this. I was out with my buddies and we were hanging out at the bar, having some drinks. And this guy said something and man, just so angry. I was pissed. I was really just picturing just grabbing him by the back of the head and smashing his face into the bar. And that's all I could think of. But you know what? I knew that wasn't good. And so I left and, I paid my tab and I went home and, so I'm doing pretty well. And they're like, okay, Brian, let's wind that back a little bit. Like, right. You don't have to get, you don't have to get to that point where you're that angry over something. What this person did kind of didn't really need to rise to that level. And I was like, oh, and that was the first initial exposure I had, like, hey, wind the tape back a little bit. Here are the things that bother you, and then know that going into here and expect certain things, because that way it just doesn't affect you. You don't get that same emotional response or emotional register.
So let's focus pull that situation, Brian. Let's take a look at it from another's perspective, the essence of tactical cunning. So if I now came home from work, the kids are just sitting down at the table. I see that the wife or significant other or husband has made a meal and I start eating the meal and we're engaged and embroiled in an argument. And it's a spontaneous argument. The same thing always about working tomorrow and you getting the overtime and who's going to take the kids. And now the argument escalates and I drop a plate or I throw a dish. And now the argument escalates and all of a sudden I slap you or you slap me or throw something at me. Neighbors had called police. The police are on scene. And now I'm in my own house with the prospect that you're going to put handcuffs on me and take me to jail. I'm completely outside of the register of the normal, clinically normal. And now all of a sudden, all those baseline elements have come in. And I'm not only overcome by emotions, I'm overwhelmed by the events of the situation. And you go, well, sir, turn around. I'm going to take you in custody in front of your kids and your wife and screaming and all that. And we wonder how these situations escalate to a cop getting killed. We wonder how a husband or wife becomes a family annihilator. Brian, the emotional toll is such that our entire society is based on emotions to keep you in check and form a society and go forward. So those are big ticket items. And if we can understand that, look, if I can understand them in me, I can turn the flashlight on you. If I can understand them in me, I can turn the laser on you. And that understanding is crucial. And that's where training comes in. Training helps me prepare for the real event by anticipating spirals.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to kind of wrap everything we've talked about.
With a fun story.
The fun story about the
homicide and the suicide.
Let
me throw that at you about the suicide
things on the faith of the earth. So, that's definitely something that it's both the emotion and the events that transpire together to lead to just there's only I mean the likelihood of a bad outcome is so high in those situations.
So the anticipation must be there. We have to slow down. We have to use the gift of time and distance. So one thing I'll throw at you, my final comments for the episode, Brian, suicide. We look at suicide from the person that commits it. I say that we need to look at it from societal grief. What emotions do we have post-suicide as a society that person couldn't equate in their own life? And if we can take a look at that, that's a good starting point. And nobody's there yet, you know. So please call us.
It's a great, you know, OBE kind of example. And then now you get into how people, you know, deal with that or how they react to that. And some people, it's, you know, for the suicide example, it's they take on more responsibility, right? Meaning they're saying, it's all my fault. I'm the problem. So I'd be better off and the tribe would be better off if I wasn't here, because I wouldn't be draining resources and time. Whereas, you know, the person who then goes and shoots up the place or kills some people, you know, they're doing the exact opposite. They're taking no responsibility. They're completely OBE, but they're taking no responsibility.
I have no consequences.
You know,
exactly.
It's not my fault. It's everyone else's fault. And
society,
you know,
made
that guy's fault. And that girl's fault, and I think it because they won't sleep with me, and whatever stupid terms you want to come up with today, or back to the Andrew Kehoe one, you know, the worst, you know, school shooting in U.S. history in 1925, you know, and it was he posted a sign that criminals are made, not born. It's like, oh, okay, that's you saying I take no responsibility for my situation in life. It's everyone else's fault that caused me to be here. So those two are great. To sort of juxtapose, because they're the same thing. It's OBE, one person taking way too much responsibility and the other taking none. And so it's a good way to kind of compare those two.
Yeah, I agree. And for the record, Brian and I were both incels in junior high school and high school, and we didn't.
Yeah. Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Good point. And good episode, because look, we've circled the wagons and explained from both sides, OBE and OBE, and from the inside and the outside. And folks, if you have any further questions, just write Brian.
Yeah.
We can go much deeper on Patreon. It's all in the textbook if you want to look it up.
Yeah.
And there's many examples that we give in class and on our webinars.
Absolutely. There's always more. There's always room for Jello. And we've got
there's always room for Jello.
We've got a lot of Jello. So thanks.
Don't push me down, Clark.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. We appreciate it. And please share it with your friends if you enjoy it. It helps get the word out there. And don't forget that training changes behavior. That's all for today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. We do appreciate it. If you'd like more information or deeper dive on anything that we talked about, you can always sign up at our Patreon site or reach out to us at thehumanbehaviorpodcast@gmail.com.